Duck South Studios in Oxford, Mississippi.
We're mass communicating.
It's a bold strategy, Cotton. Let's see if it pays off for them.
This is the End of the Line podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.
I gave it a 10.
Sweep the leg. You have a problem with that.
And now, here are your hosts, Rocky LaFleur.
Everybody on? Good.
Great. Grand. Wonderful.
No yelling on the bus.
Josh Webb.
Sorry I had a fight familiar, your butt at the party.
And Jake Latondras.
I am bad news.
Also starring Rob Kroon.
I bet this guy's into the woods $100.
And Bradley Ramsey.
No, Mark, didn't say it.
Showtime.
All right, here we go. Hold your ears, folks. It's showtime.
Showtime, everybody! Showtime!
Welcome to the End of the Line podcast. I'm Rocky LaFleur, sitting in the Duck South Studios on this Thursday, Bradley?
I think it's Thursday in my world.
Yeah, I bet you kind of get lost on days when you're that far away from home and it's just a steady pace of oil and gas business.
Yeah, and working days and nights and nights and days and back and forth, I don't keep up with time. I just, you know, there is no weekend in the oil field, so it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter to me at all.
I guess we could be like Rob Kroon. It could be Monday.
Well, or it could be, instead of being Valentine's Day, it could be St. Swithin's Day.
Oh, boy, Valentine's. Thanks for the reminder.
Yeah, go get your flowers. Don't make Roy Ann mad.
Is that not a... You know, I can't remember what movie or TV show it was on, but a holiday created by the greeting card or candy business.
You know, it's sales. To me, I think it is. I mean, my wife and I have a semi-agreement on it. You know, it's not a holiday that we've strictly, you know, she ain't mad if I don't send flowers. I will always, you know, send her a Valentine's note or just, you know, tell her I love her, which I do every day anyhow, but I just don't buy into the marketing of it. You know, it's kids, of course, in school have to have all their Valentine's stuff, but it don't mean anything. You know, it's all about selling flowers and cards, I think.
Isn't it amazing that roses go from about $2 a single rose to about $9 overnight? In 1 week?
Yeah. And, you know, the chocolate sales and everything else. I mean, the rose one just blows me away because I have a little bit of a green thumb, and, you know, the factory farm roses, they don't have any smell to them. They just look like they're plastic. They die in about a day. Nothing says love like, you know, something that's going to wither in about 24 hours. I don't get it.
Well, look, coming up in just a minute, Randy Russell is joining us all the way down in Mexico. We talk a little Mexico. We talk about Ramsey's kind of summarizes the season for him and a lot of his outfits across the nation. Pretty interesting podcast. Hey, Bradley, speaking of love, man, you have got some, as much as these guys from the FFL obsess and follow you around, and it can make a great Lifetime movie.
Yeah, I do have a little cult following for some reason. I am, in certain circles, I think I'm the most hated man in duck hunting.
Man, I can't think of the kid's name, but say kid, he's probably an adult. I don't know. Everybody, once you get past about 40 years old, everybody becomes a kid. That you
remember. Oh, for sure.
But anyway, it's one guy, man. It's no matter where you post, except in Duck South, because I kicked him out a few weeks ago because I was sick of it. But it seems like that guy follows you around. And it is fun. It's actually fun to watch.
I think I know who you're talking about. And you know,
I'm not saying a name on this podcast. I'm not
I have not. I'm not gonna say I succeeded 100% of the time, but when these type of people come after me and can't dispute the facts and the science that I put out there and want to delve into personal attacks, I try to stay above all that, because you're not doing anything when you just delve into personal attacks. You know, if you can't defend your premise with facts and science and data, and you degrade to just attacking a person, you've lost the argument to begin with.
All right, well, let me set it up for people. Let me get this picture in your head. So whenever these topics of discussion come up, leaning toward the FFL and their arguments, blah, 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 Bradley always goes in. I don't think you chase these posts around. You just have to see them in your feed, and you shoot them down with facts. Well,
right.
The thing that I've noticed from the guys from the FFL is they argue about two comments when it comes to the facts, and then they always make this move. It's like their spin move of basketball. Every single time, you know they're going to spin to the right. So as soon as you shoot them down with a couple of facts, they make that spin move to the right, and they're like, hey, where were you in 2004 with Ducks Unlimited pilot flying over southeastern Louisiana and Lake Charles at 11:41? It's always something like that. Hey, weren't it's you the always... editor of a magazine? Well, yeah. What does that have to do with the facts that we're discussing?
They keep trying to paint me as a paid stooge for conservation organizations, and it just tickles me. The whole one about the flight with the biologist. I mean, this guy came at me, he's like, well, where are your flight logs? I'm like, well, first of all, I'm not a pilot. Second of all, I wasn't flying a survey. But here's the photos. Oh, well, you just pulled those off the internet. I'm like, oh, man, come on, whatever. My favorite was the other day when this guy tried to quote me and pulled up articles from 2002 that had no byline on them. For those of you who don't know the writing world, if something doesn't have a byline, it could be written by multiple people. It's just a general statement. But I read the stuff, and I'm like, that doesn't sound like me. I don't, that's not how I write. And I've been writing for a long time. I know how I sound. I said, man, I don't really think I wrote that. Oh, are you sure? I said, well, yeah, tell you what. I'll check with my former publisher. And sure enough, I didn't start writing for these people until 2004. And when I pointed it out to this guy, I was like, oh, well, you're just covering. I mean, since you didn't have a byline on it, you wouldn't sign your name to it. You could have been writing for them whenever you wanted to. I'm like, oh, let's just, come on, man. Come on.
Let me play this out in the background is how I see it, okay? Whenever you dispute the cult with facts, it's always, no matter which, imagine this circle. You got the head of the cult as the circle, right? Okay? And you've got all these little fingerlings coming off of it. So let's follow Bradley. All the little fingerlings or lines off the middle circle is following Bradley around. Now, whenever you dispute anything with facts, they run back to the head circle, and he says, and it's almost like a Democrat. You know, whenever you catch a Democrat in, they try to make you look somewhere else. Look over here.
Yeah.
Instead of actually disputing or arguing or debating the facts, let's take your attention away from that and make up some outlandish stuff. And it's always looked like these people are just running back to the head of the cult, getting something to take your attention away and putting it up there.
Oh yeah, and I've called them out on that. I said, you know what? It's funny to me that every time you want to come at me.
There's time lapse in between there. You're having a serious debate and you have a fact. It's boom, 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 4 minutes ago, 5 minutes ago, 6 minutes ago. You're not taking 30 minutes or an hour in between comments. It's usually somebody feeding you information to put up there when it's that long.
And when it's the same verbatim attack that's been dispelled time and time again. They didn't just come up with that on their own. When it's the exact same, well, what did you do? I understand you do this, or you did this as a past for a living, or you worked for this company. I mean, they've even gone now to where the fact that I worked as a researcher for production crops for Monsanto has tied me into the corn lobby so that I was researching duck corn for Monsanto. Monsanto could give two rat's butts about a duck hunter.
That's the truth.
But yeah, I mean, it's and it's the same. It's the same attacks. They come back at me. They don't have any. That's like I said. I try to be polite. I try to just state facts, state science. If I don't have the research, provide them with links, provide them with data. And every time I do it, it turns right around into, let's discredit the source. And I'm not a biologist. I'm not anybody in the duck hunting world. I'm just a guy who studied this his entire life and happens to know a lot of people who are biologists and conservationists and duck hunters. And I study this stuff because I'm a geek about it. And, you know, but apparently I am public enemy number one among that group.
Over and that, under. I'm gonna get an over under from you.
All right.
Hey, I'm gonna give you an over under on this, but I do want to close out talking about one main point. That as crazy as it sounds, I agree with FFL on.
Okay.
All right. Over under. One of my favorite shows on TV is Shark Tank. Love Shark Tank.
Okay. Yeah.
Kevin O'Leary sits in the middle. And whenever he hates a product, he always says that product's not going to be competitive in the market. He always says that the bigger companies are going to squash you like the bug you are. That's his favorite line to use.
Yep.
All right. So how long before FFL is squashed like the bug they are? Hello. One year?
I'll say this. I can hear their exoskeleton cracking right now. It's happening as we speak. There's multiple pages now that have come up that are simply dedicated to dispelling their myths. And that has nothing to do with Duck South. That has nothing to do with me. I haven't started any of them. But people of reason and logic are stepping forward and speaking up. I don't think that conspiracy will never go away because it's been happening my entire life as a duck hunter. But the volume of their speaker is going to go from an 11 to about a 2 within the next year. Nobody's going to listen to it anymore.
There's a lot of people with a lot of bad duck seasons out that are following. That thing's growing like crazy. And that's all you need to create a cult following like that is a bunch of weak-minded individuals that'll believe anything.
But we went through this before, Rocky. We went through it. You know, we didn't have social media at the time to this extent. These kind of claims and screams and moanings happened back in the early 2000s. And science came up and spoke about it and addressed the issue. And eventually people said, I guess we're not going to get anywhere with this. The people that were just bandwagon jumpers heard the science, heard the facts, and walked away. And it took the steam out of the engine. The best thing to take steam out of the engine would be for us to have another banner duck season. And we've had them since the last time this argument came up. And people shut up and stop complaining. What people don't understand is duck hunters today, I'm one of them, we're spoiled. 60-day season, 6 birds. We've had the sky's the limit for a long time. It's cyclical. We're going to have slow years. We'll see seasons get reduced. I'm not advocating for it, but we'll see it happen. And, when the birds come back and people have a good season, nobody's going to listen to the criers and the moaners. So I don't think they've got a year left in them, honestly.
One thing I'd close this out with that I may get burnt Hades and back for saying this. One thing that I do agree with the FFL alone is the volume, the amount of agriculture crops being planted on WMAs and refuges.
Well,
I agree with
you. Know, That's interesting you should bring that up. I posted a link the other night on the new website for the Southern Regional Office of the National Wildlife Service. And it goes into great detail explaining how much agriculture is used, why that is used.
And it fell off. It's fell way off. It's gone to, I read something to the point of it's 40,000, which it was 120 or 200,000 acres or something.
It was 100,000 just in the southern regional area. That's Mississippi, Tennessee, Missouri, the southern end of the flyway. So it's dropped. I'm kind of on the fence about this because, you know, duck energetics are a thing. And when you tell the Fish and Wildlife Service your job for this refuge is to provide X number of energy days for ducks, you're working within a framework of how many acres do I have, what will produce that kind of energy. So I can see some of that. What I don't agree with...
Let me ask you, before you dive off deeper, by the time ducks get here, they need protein. Moist soil provides that.
Yeah.
That is their main need, okay? Once you start providing hot food, in the sense of corn,
right?
You kind of goes back to what Josh and them are saying. You're kind of holding them up a little bit. Make those suckers move.
Yeah, but, you know, the same thing that when you look at the total energetic needs of waterfowl, yes, at certain times of the year, their principal need is protein, but they're also going to eat carbs. It's like, you know, ducks don't go on a keto diet during certain parts of the migration. As weather changes, their intake of carbs changes to fluctuate their body temperature with weather and things like that. I'm all for where it's feasible having principally more soil vegetation on sanctuaries. I think it's actually a great idea. But that's, I can tell you from personal experience, more soil doesn't work on every piece of ground. And you can't make a farmer who you're getting a lease conjunction with on a federal refuge plant more soil. That has to be done on owned lands. So I don't agree with, and I've said this before, on a federal sanctuary, if they're going to plant crops, I do not think you should be allowed to, quote unquote, bait it by mowing that stuff down, shattering it, scattering it, whatever. I think if you're providing an attractant to keep birds away from hunters, not just provide sanctuary, you're working against the best interest of hunters who are the principal drivers of conservation. If you want to harvest it and then flood it up as sanctuary, rock on. You know, if you want to leave a certain percentage of it standing and flood it up, fine. But the practices that are happening on some, not all, but some refuges of, well, we've got this mandate to meet X number of energy days, so we're just going to plant crops so that we can meet that, rather than working intensively on moist soil. It's a cheap way to get to a number rather than work diligently towards the goal, in my opinion.
I would agree. I mean, not 100%, but I agree with you.
Well, you know, I'm not a biologist. This new website from the Southern Regional has taught me a lot about what their mandates are. And look, government mandates can be ridiculous. You know, you say, okay, well, your job at Refuge X or Y is to produce, let's just make another number up, 15,000 duck use energy days per year. Okay, so their job depends on them doing that. It's easier sometimes to do that with crops than it would be with moist soil. It may not be possible to do it with moist soil, the number of acres they have, but their bosses are still saying, this is your task that you have to do. And it's an overarching picture of how many energy days they need in the entire flyway, but it doesn't manage on a local level, and habitat is localized to a large extent during the migration, but habitat also stretches from coast to Canada. So we get away from managing the whole resource and down into managing the local area, your lines get blurred and it becomes a distribution issue.
You know, the thing that I know about the federal government is it takes them forever to realize that they have a problem. And I'm not saying they do have a problem. Two fine examples of this. Morgan Brake, National Refuge, right there where I grew up. It took them 7 years to finally get somebody's attention to say, hey, we've got a hog problem. There's, you know, within a couple of years, there's going to be no deer left on this place. Right. We're going to do something about it.
Right.
No deer, no turkeys, anything. Alligators. The federal government, alligators are out of control. Where in places where I remember my uncle being on the front page of the Clarion Ledger with an alligator in the mid-80s. Now, every ditch you ride through from about LaFleur County south, there's nothing but alligators.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, that's part of the problem is the regulation.
That's a federal issue.
It is a federal issue. And when the people who aren't interested in the hunting and the what's called consumptive sports are also some of the people holding the reins, then you start dealing with, oh, well, we need to do an environmental impact study, and we need a 5-year pilot program to do this, and we need to look at it, we need to form a committee, and we need to do this, when the facts are right there staring you in the face. I don't think it's an unwillingness. I think it is the overburdensome, slow cogs of government wheels moving. If you look at the stuff on the Southern Regional Office page, they're talking about, we need to look at what sanctuary really means. We need to look at the impact of disturbance on hunter satisfaction and on the birds. We need to look at the impact of agriculture. But how long it will take them to figure that study out and get the funding for it, because nobody wants to pay the government to go study why does a duck fly over here. Not extra funding. So this is where good intentions can look like they are foot dragging just because of the cumbersomeness of the federal system. Unlike you, when I was a child, the first alligator I saw was a spectacle, and now they are everywhere. There's absolutely no reason that there is a alligator release program from alligator farms in Louisiana, where if you raise alligators for commercial living, you have to release X number back to the wild. Why would you need to do that? There's more alligators in Louisiana than there ever been. But, you know, it's just government slow to change.
I'll never forget one of my buddies calling the person that was in charge of Matthew's Brake one time and said, hey, I just want to let you know you got water hyacinths out here in Matthew's Brake. She said, yes, we have a lot of great species of plants in Matthew's Brake. Which, baby, you better do something about it. It's going to take over the whole thing.
Yeah.
And, of course, it took them a couple of years of it spreading like wildfire, and they finally cut it back. But anyway.
Yeah, government is slow to change. But, you know, overall, I think we have to tip our hat to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and conservation organizations for actually maintaining a resource that we nearly decimated by overhunting, by destruction of habitat. By industrialization and by urbanization. The fact that we still have a huntable population of waterfowl after the near devastation from the Dust Bowl and overhunting and the industrial issues, you got to say that's a pretty good job. It may not please us season to season, but as a whole, we still have a viable and huntable population of waterfowl in this country. And that didn't happen just because we duck hunters wanted it. It happened because science and government actually stepped in. And I'm not all about government control, but you know these things had a role in helping us sustain this population.
Hey, God, listen, I got something interesting we can take this into that, you know, a little bit further. You know, at other times when we've been in this low cyclical pattern of waterfowling, there were a lot of things for ducks to come back to.
Yeah.
I want to jump into some habitat stuff next time we're on here together, talking about if we are really going through that bottom or heading toward the bottom of a cycle, what are ducks going to come back to when we start going back up?
Right.
I want to talk a little bit about that.
we can catch up on that next time. It's definitely worth talking about because it is the whole picture versus the what's in front of my blind. And what does this year look like versus what is it going to look like 10 years from now?
Yeah, we'll jump back into it. We'll be back together the first of next week. So we'll get into
good deal.
It. Bradley, we need to get to that interview with Ramsey now. Thank you again for being here. But we need to get to Ramsey in Mexico now. All right, guys, like I told you on the front end of the podcast, Ramsey Russell back with us, old double R2 himself. Ramzilla, stop killing all the freaking ducks in Mexico. These people in Louisiana are going to string you up.
Can't do it, man. Can't do it. I cannot believe how terrible the season was back home. And real worried about Mexico. And even in December now, they didn't have a bunch of ducks in December. One of our outfitters held a lot of Mexican business in December, and he canceled hunts. And then somewhere around one of the fronts that hit in January blew a bunch of ducks down, and it's good. It's been I tell you what, the last couple of weeks has been fun. That's the best way I can say it. And I ain't gonna lie to you, Rocky. I was down in Bottle Line last week with eight couples. And I was just glad to be there, you know, glad to get away from this city season and just put that season behind me. I mean, just bury it in a hole and forget about it. And it was unbelievable. You know, just imagine this, y'all. You go to Mexico, 50, 60 degrees, 70 degrees on the warm afternoon. Like I'm sitting in Obregon right now. It's 81 degrees. But you show up to the beautiful resort hotel. You gotta be lightning flash to open the door for yourself. They open the door. They do everything. They usher you up to your room. It's a beautiful balcony overlooking the ocean and the marina. You hear the band down there by the pool at happy hour. And go out there and just kind of recreate and have a good time and meet everybody. And next morning at 5 o'clock, go downstairs and get a cup of coffee and sweet rolls. And it picks up at 5:30 and we drive, 45 minutes. We arrive to just a little, I don't know, a little old, some ponds, some little, like old shrimp ponds, kind of brushy, kind of like old catfish ponds with some willow trees and stuff growing up in them. Water shallow, clouds of ducks flying. It's 7 o'clock in the morning. You could see the chute for 30 minutes. That's okay. We're wearing our tennis shoes and a waiter's wearing shorts and dark shirts, and we go out, we break off into teams of two, and an hour and a half later, maximum, we're all sitting back at the truck, drinking cold cervezas, and they made a little fire, and warmed up some bean and beef burritos, and some roasted serrano peppers. We all had a little snack, and took some pictures, and had a great time, and just every day we're shooting blue wing, green wing, and cinnamon teal, some shovelers, of course, a few pintails, a few widgeons, a few gadwalls, a lot of teal. We're all back at the resort hotel at 11:30, 12 o'clock. And, you know, it's real hard, Rocky, it's real, real hard being from Mississippi, being, you know, traveling around, having clients from all these big cities, and looking at the 6 o'clock news every night. It's real hard me to be just a professional when I get this answer. You know, I get this question all the time. How safe is Mexico? I've been reading the State Department report, and I saw something in the paper 2 weeks ago, and, is it safe? I'm on the phone with a lady from Chicago, scared to death to go to Mazatlan. Or I live in Brandon, Mississippi. I don't go to downtown Jackson after dark. I avoid it like the plague at all times around the clock. You know, You go to Mazatlan and it's safe and it's clean and it's rocky, it's fun. Our new ad campaign this year, on the heels of this trip, our new ad campaign we're working on is duck hunting on the fun side of the border, duck hunting on the fun side of the wall down here because we have so much fun. You know, the largest shrimp fleet in Mexico goes to Mazatlan and seafood is cheap. cheaper than going eating crawfish, you know, Mississippi right now. It's cheap. Good seafood. It's cheap. Margaritas are cheap. Tequila's cheap. You walk from, we have some Texans down there that, I ain't never going turkey hunting with, man. These boys cover some ground. Both of them in their 30s, and man, they were walking 6-7 miles a day, walking through the town and meeting locals and going to little taco joints and going to the lighthouse, and they saw everything there is to see in Mile High in the Golden Zone. They would come in, and instead of hanging out by the pool relaxing, they'd put on their tennis shoes, grab up their wives, and they'd go exploring. And my Miss Anita was down there with me, and we went to a little taco stand, El Bigote, which means the mustache. And our host asked us, you know, do you like beef or pork? And I said, well, I want pork. We go to this little Spanish taco restaurant, nothing but all kinds of little tacos. And I had the ribs and had the pork shoulder, and Anita was just scoffing down. I said, okay, now do you understand why I don't care to eat Mexican food back home? Because it ain't real Mexican food, you know. And so we just had this glorious time. I mean, the last thing you think about, you shot you 20 ducks in the morning. Nickety split, 45 minutes or an hour. And the last thing you think about, the fishing and offshore and inshore and all the many things you can do, or do absolutely nothing at all, just go sit by a pool and suck down a bottle and a half margaritas. You know, you don't even think about duck hunting until the next morning. Alarm goes off, 4:45, you walk down there to Pride, get a cup of coffee, catch up with everybody, and then go do it again. It's absolutely one of the funnest vacations, because your wife can go and have a great time without even pulling the trigger, and you're going to have a great time shooting ducks and then hanging out with her. And we got back I was down there the very end of January, first of February, and came home for a few days and regrouped. That's all I did, was regroup. I've got about a 3-week stretch down here in Obregon, which is one of our top hunts in the world for good reason. It's ducks and doves, and sometimes brant and bass fishing. And just had a big media hunt. Benelli and Sitka and myself had some riders come down from Outdoor Life. And Delta Waterfowl, Sporting Classics, and Safari Club International magazine. And it was so much fun, Rocky, because we totally just mixed up every day. Just mixed up groups, swapped up groups, went to different blinds every day. And, you know, I like to read, and I like to read hunt magazines. But, man, the stories these guys had, that you never seen written, you know, just some of the funny stories behind the scenes and all that good stuff. It was just a ride. And everybody brought a lot of perspective from inside the industry and seeing things. We talked about conservation. We talked about hunting globally, and we shot ducks. And you know, they all said that it was one of the funnest hunts they'd ever been on. They just had fun down here in Mexico, you know, fun side of the wall, the fun side of the border. And, but that's where I'm at, Rocky. And you know, you bring up a good subject. Oh, you know, y'all kill all those ducks down in Mexico. That's why we don't kill 1/10 tail up here.
That's what I was gonna say. So if the people north of us are short stopping them, you're gonna be called, you and your guides down there, y'all are gonna be called long stoppers, right?
Oh yeah. I mean, Jake was down here filming an episode of Life Short Get Ducks, and I held up a few pintails yesterday, and I said, the camera said, I said, y'all do understand that because of these three birds, because I shot these three pintails, there will be no pintails in the United States of America next year. That's what the rumor is. And it just couldn't be far from the truth. You know, one thing I hope to accomplish, I told Jake and I talked a long time about this. I said, Jake, you know, one of the things I really hope to accomplish with this video project we're working on is just to teach people that the duck hunting world is a lot bigger than their backyard. And I love these guys that get on social media. My patience has really withered a lot recently. I just, you know, I don't have the time I don't have the inclination to explain to some person I don't know that comes into our social media and just starts railing against the system and railing against me and anybody having fun shooting ducks. I just, or pen pals or pick a subject. I just don't have the patience for it anymore.
Hey, Ramsey, I want to ask you this. Look, take weather out of the equation. Let's don't even talk about weather. Look, you work with a lot of people from a large amount of the U.S. and Canada. Where, according to Get Ducks, where were the ducks? Where
I don't
were the
know,
concentration
Rocky, I
of
I
ducks
they were,
that we're used to?
I don't know because you know, I get to talk duck hunters and duck outfitters every single day, all day. It's what I do. And then I go to shows, Dallas Safari Club, Safari Club International, and I meet with them. And, of course, they come into the booth. We talk about how their season went. We talk about duck hunting. And nobody had a good season this year. Nobody had the kind of season they'll remember. It was a very forgettable season at best. Nobody got into the ducks and stuck with the ducks. Nobody had ducks all the time. I hear of a few clubs and a few locations that did good, but nobody did great. And I really don't know where the ducks were, if they were. I heard some of the craziest things from men that have been hunting for 30 or 40 years. To hear somebody that's been hunting in the Sac Valley of California for 40 years say, I think they just need to shut the season down and let these ducks rebuild. To hear a 90-year-old wildlife commissioner from Louisiana that is not a part of that Louisiana group that's black helicopter conspiracies, tell me about a conversation he had with a federal biologist that was predicting where the birds were, blah, blah, blah. And he called BS. He said, BS, I don't believe you. I think your numbers are wrong. Show me where those birds are right now. You can't. You know, there's a lot of people, Rocky, that are dubious of the science, of the counting. There's a lot of people that believe that adaptive harvest management wasn't the right model. That it dipped too far into principle instead of interest. Me, I don't know. I really don't know. I just know that, I do know that I don't see massive flocks of mallards that I saw 15, 20 years ago. I don't see, now truthfully, I would rather work mallards when the mallards are in. I'd rather work bunches of ones and twos and fives and 50 and 100 and 500. But I miss seeing that spectacle of 50 mallards circling and 50 more mallards joining them and 100 more mallards joining them and seeing a cloud of a couple, 200, 300 ducks above you working. And I haven't seen that in a long time. I hadn't seen it in too long. But I don't know where the ducks are.
Hey, I'm gonna tell you this. One person that you spend a lot of time with, I guess it was probably a couple of weeks ago. I've been missing from social media and from kind of unplugged for a couple of weeks now. But one person you were with a couple of weeks ago was Chris Wujcik, right?
Yeah.
All right. So
yeah, he comes to show with us.
All right, correct me if I'm wrong. And I don't want to freak people out by saying what I'm about to say, but we're in a crisis situation when it comes to the pothole region of Canada. Maybe not so much in North and South Dakota, but the prairie pothole region of Canada, it is in a crisis mode. And you and I talked about this a couple of weeks ago. Yeah, I know we hadn't talked about it on the air, but barring a miracle blizzard, we're in for a tough spring.
Yeah, we are. And that's what I've been hearing, not just from one particular outfitter, but from several, is that, you know, last year I was up in Canada for a long time. And any outfitter up there, a lot of those outfitters will tell you, they were covering a lot of ground because the concentrations of waterfowl, the concentrations of ducks were apart. You know, it wasn't just contiguous everywhere. a lot of ducks here, an hour away to be some ducks, 2 hours away to be some ducks, concentrated. You know, a lot of ducks kind of concentrated in the local area because of water. You know, the prairie seems to have been getting drier. And what I'm hearing is that, you know, lacking a wet, heavy blizzard, a lot of snow getting dumped in March, that it's going to be dry in the prairie pothole. You know, Rocky, there at Willowbrake, the water got so high in South Delta, Mississippi, they shut the seasons down in most of the counties over there. It was spring-like flooding conditions in my part of the world, South Delta. It was just like what you're used to seeing in April, May, June, when all snowpack melts off and starts coming down that great big continental ditch known as the Mississippi River and backing all the tributaries up.
It's just a wall of water coming down the Mississippi River.
It was all the rain, all the precipitation that usually comes in the form of snow up in the Midwest and upper flyway came in the form of rain and just came all down the river. And so it's worrisome to me. I'm not a smart enough man to understand how they count ducks, what the error is, what the factor is. I don't know. I just don't know. I trust blindly, I guess, but I trust bean counters with the smart guys that are doing that stuff. I trust that they know what the numbers are and that the model works. I do believe that the U.S. has got, at least we're counting, at least we're throwing a lot of time and money and energy into it. At least we've got some smart people working on it. A lot of countries can't say that. Most countries can't say that. There is no censusing of waterfowl like that. But every time we get into statistics, all I really know about statistics is what a statistics professor told me about there being lies, damn lies in statistics. You know, there's error in statistics. You know, who knows? I just don't know. I worry that you know, snow geese can get so out of hand, we only shoot five of them, and all of a sudden we got to shoot 20. Because they're out of hand. If the numbers can be wrong on one side, they can be wrong on another. I hope that's not the case, but I worry. And I know that I told Forrest this year, 21 years, since he's been hunting his lifetime, 21 years, all he's known is 6 and 60 in the Mississippi Flyway. That's a long time. Since my son started hunting, my 21-year-old son started hunting. All he's ever known is a 60-day season, 6 ducks, 4 mallards. And that's kind of, I wonder about that. I don't know.
I'm going to tell you, I'm like your friend, man. I think it's time to give him a break. Listen, I may be the most hated man in the world for saying this on the air. I think it's time to give him a little bit of a break.
I don't know, Rocky. I don't know. You know, I really wish I knew the answer to that. You get back into Pintail, you know, don't take Randy's word. Go Google it. Google is a powerful tool with a lot of information. And there were papers, research studies written, you know, that have demonstrated that the reason that Pintail populations are not doing well is because they historically nested in short grass prairies. Short grass prairies very easily converted to agriculture. The agricultural trend for soil conservation and environment is no-till farming, which means when those nesting pintails show back up to the prairie pothole region, there's a whole lot of barley stubble, residual stubble from last year. Looks and functions to them a lot like short grass prairie. They go and make their nest. Well, here comes the farming operators establishing this year's crop. And they run over some hens and they run over a lot of eggs. And, you know, no amount of, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? And that's really what's happening to Pintail. To their populations, and that's why, you know, it's not who's shooting what on pintails. I mean, you know, nobody down here is shooting tens of thousands of pintails. You know, it's just a fact that more pintails at one a day are dying in Louisiana and California and probably Arkansas than get shot down in Mexico an entire season. You know, you're just not talking tens of thousands, let alone hundreds of thousands of hunters that come to Mexico. You're talking hundreds, a few thousand. And the numbers just are so much different, you know, and a lot of people jump on a social media just a tirade about, you know, shooting liberal limits in Mexico. I'm like, wait a minute. You do know the limit on pintail is 8 in Alaska, right? Might be 1 in California and 1 in Oklahoma, but it's 8 in Alaska. And it's 8 in Canada. And it's more than that in Mexico, but it's not endless. It's finite. And you know, if the biologists are right, if hunting is additive, a little compensatory, you know, then it's right. But shooting a few thousand pintails is not why pintails are in trouble. It's just not. I guess, you know, for all I know, it's not. But I don't know, Rocky. It's been one of those kind of seasons with all that mess you read online and all the conspiracy theories and my own possible observations. You know, a lot of scientists and biologists say that anecdotal observations, what I see in the blind, what you see in the blind, and, you know, what other people just see in the blind, aren't conclusive. They aren't valid because they're not statistical. They're not mathematical. It's not empirical data. But just as somebody that talks to duck hunters nationwide, all day, every day, I would say that maybe anecdotal observations are not the final answer, but I believe the body of evidence, the topic of conversations, not just in Louisiana, Mississippi, Arkansas, but nationwide, demand a reevaluation of the system. At least let's just look under the hood and make sure everything's working right. Let's just make sure. What could that
possibly mean? And that's what I meant earlier. I'm not saying take a break. I mean just ease up and see what's going on.
It's a pretty arrogant collection of people that just don't even consider the possibility that they're wrong. I mean, I can tell you this for a fact. I am often wrong, never in doubt. You know, I mean, but I will admit, I can be wrong at times. And you know, let's just take a look. You know, let's just take a look. I don't know, Rocky. That's just it. I don't know where the ducks were because nobody I talked to nationwide, absolutely just in the thick of things all season long. Now, I took that char dog of mine, that new puppy, to a trainer up in Carbondale, Illinois. Been a few weeks ago, week before I came, I guess, down to Mexico. And I drove up and dropped it off. He's going to pick her up. And those boys right there in Carbondale, Illinois, right there, the ground backyard, that part of the world, said the worst season they'd ever had until the last 2 or 3 days. They say the matters came in thick. From wherever they were, they say the last 2 days of ducks, like it should have been. So maybe they were north of there. Maybe they were somewhere. There was a lot of water everywhere, not just in the Mississippi Delta, but there was a lot of water everywhere to really disperse ducks. But
see,
it's very disheartening, you know.
I think that is the biggest factor that nobody is counting in all this, is the wide availability of water everywhere. And then on top of that, the number of farmers that weren't able to harvest from Missouri north, all that food went underwater. you know, not all of it, but the food that were that was next to the bodies of water, rivers, or that jumped. I know in Iowa alone, there were thousands and thousands of acres that didn't get harvested of corn next to the Mississippi River that sat underwater.
Yep, it's there's a lot of water everywhere, a lot of place for ducks to hide. You know, to ask me where the ducks were this year, I don't know. I really don't know, and I've talked to too many people that just shrug about their duck season. You know, and the people I know that truly, really, truly say they had a great season are just, it's not the hunters that have been hunting for 20 to 40 years. It's not us. You know, it's nobody that I've talked to that's only 20 to 40 years had a quote great season, unquote. Nobody. Not at all. And I'm so glad convention came and I could get out of duck blind, not killing ducks, and go do something. You know, I couldn't believe it. You know, I was so looking forward to that. And I did. And just tad depressing going to convention and talking to everybody. That was just down the doldrums. Now, on the flip side of it is, a lot of folks going to Argentina and around the world, duck season somewhere, hunting ducks. Argentina's going to be red hot this year, especially the good operators like ours. It's going to be perfect. The water conditions are through the roof. Productivity is perfect. And it's going to be a great season. And thankfully, remember that real cold front we got right there towards the end of season in Mississippi? That last big cold snap. Remember when last week of season, I was leaving for Mexico, and it was snowing at my house. One of the warmest, miserable seasons I can remember, it was snowing the morning I was flying the model line, and all I could think is, holy cow, I'm fixing to get iced out on flying to Mexico to shoot ducks. This is unbelievable. And it did. And we got to go out. But, you know, there's just a lot of photo period migrators, teal, gadwall, widgeons, pintails. They all came down here. And they didn't come in the normal slug they did, but they all ended up down here. And with those cold fronts that did kind of snap in the Pacific Central Flyways, it swept them on down into Mexico. Maybe not in their normal numbers, but in the 80-90% of their normal numbers are here now. Lots of pintails, lots of regions. It's been very enjoyable just to see ducks. It's been to go out in a blind and see ducks and call ducks and ducks come in like they're supposed to, like we all live for. It's been good. I ain't gonna lie to you, the first morning in my lawn, I was up with an old client of mine and they set us off. Getting everybody in position, finds okay, you load your guns to shoot. Man, we lit into them like, blah, 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 blah. I mean, just high level, left, right, front of you, behind you. It's just like, finally, we just took a deep breath, like, all right, like, settle down. We're not grade kids. We're not grade school kids. Let's just settle down and really hunt. So we really started hunting and got our limits pretty darn quick. Hey, Rock, I got to tell you, this is crazy. There's a lot of feed, of course. You know, these birds are coming in. They're feeding a lot out brackish water out here in western Mexico. And one of the biggest draws to waterfowl in Mexico is fresh water. Fresh water. All these mudflats, you see a lot of these ducks out here feeding at low tide and in some of the real, real shallow water. They're feeding just like shorebirds. They're eating a lot of these invertebrates. But they're coming in to fresh water. And our guy down in Mazatlan, and I were sitting there talking, we got to the hotel one day, he said, tomorrow's going to be fun. He said, you hadn't seen this place. And I'm taking y'all tomorrow. He said, y'all are all going to kind of hunt together. I'm like, all 8 of us? He goes, it'll be fine, trust me, amigo. So we get there, and there's this huge, huge low water area. And when we pull up, it's just a little sliver of a little ditch, a little shallow. Like it's a huge area of mud flat. coming down where we kind of stopped was this sliver, maybe 5 yards wide and inches deep, coming out and feeding into this, like this pool out there of about, half an acre to three quarters of an acre. And beyond it opened up the big body of sheet water. And when we got there, that whole sliver, that whole little finger coming out for about 100 yards, the whole little acre or two of water was wall to wall, stacked three deep on top of each other duck. And it was, I'm like, wow. And down where those ducks were was five blinds about 5 yards apart. Five two-man blinds about 5 yards apart, right there where that finger came into that little pool. And what he explained was, this won't be here in about 10 more days, but this is fresh water coming in. And that all the ducks are coming. There's a big area about 2 miles from here with a lot of ducks on it. But he said they're coming in right here during the day. And he said, and they'll be coming in all day long. They'll be coming in. And he said, but in about 10 or 15 more days, this thing will dry up and there won't be any fresh water. They're coming in to drink. So we put on rubber boots and we walked the length of the football field. We all got in our little two-man blinds. We could talk. We could have a conversation like a big pit blind. And then it started. And it was unbelievable. It was, Rocky, it took us 45 minutes to get our limits. And sometimes we all kind of shot. But it was funny how we all kind of just, a lot of us didn't know each other till we met the day before. But, you know, we all, you know, you shoot, this blind would shoot, if every kind on the left, this blind would shoot, if every kind over center, this blind would shoot. And we all got along and just smoked them. I mean, just boom, 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 boom. Got the OK Corral, man, gunslinging. It was unbelievable for 45 minutes. And we got out and rounded up ducks. It was mostly, I'd say it was 75% green wings. Maybe, I think we shot 15 or 20 cinnamons. The rest were beautiful, beautiful, beautiful blue wing teal. It's funny how, you know, mostly it was great because you can see them so good in that sunshine. And then we walked back where the trucks were, just 150 yards away across this mud flat. And we stopped and opened up an ice chest. And some people got beer, some people got Diet Coke and water. And we sat there for an hour eating those homemade burritos and little tacos and stuff. And we watched about 6,000 ducks trickle back in and just blow into that hole. Just, we sat there and just watched it absolutely fill up again with teal and a few pintail and a few shelvers. And our guy said, are y'all ready to go back? And he said, yeah, we're about ready. He said, all right, one more show. He took a firecracker off the hood of his truck and threw it. Bam! Big old Mexican firecracker, a lot louder than ours. Boom, it went off. All the birds got up. They buzzed around, about 5,000 birds buzzed around and rallied and just whoop, started trickling right back into the hole. That's when we left. And that felt good after this duck season. That, it just felt good to shoot and have a good time and laugh, but to see any ducks again, it just felt so good. That so far has been about the highlight of a little stay in Mexico. I'll never forget just seeing that. And since then, we've had clients in Mazatlan line every single day, just coming in and going. And we call it a honeymoon duck hunt. I've got a couple out of Mississippi there right now, literally on their honeymoon, and having a great time, I'm sure. And but it's just it was a really, oh boy, a great way to. Great little event for after the Mississippi Ducks season I had this year. You know, no matter what we tried, just there weren't any ducks, Rocky. There just weren't any ducks to speak of.
I know next week we'll probably jump back off into part two of the Ramsey the Deer Hunter story. Can't wait for that. But you be careful. Hey, where will you be next Thursday?
Next Thursday, I will be here in Obregon. I've got a team coming in today, some new clients and some repeat clients. They exit out. I'm got another team coming in for 4 days, and then I will come home on the 22nd. So next Thursday's not the 22nd. I'll be down here, and you know we can meet up. Betsy, now look, Rocky, down here, this is a real duck hunt down here. We get up between 3 and 4 o'clock every morning. We drive because we're hunting. Golly, this guy's got some land, man. I mean, it's like we're on the mainland side, the east side, mainland side of Mexico, the east side of the Sea of Cortez. And there's a lot of these bays, estuaries, and that's where we're hunting in the mornings. And if we're not in the airboat and into the estuary itself, there are, you know, if you go just off that, there's millions upon millions of acres of agriculture. It's like Mount Pitt told me one time, if you've ever eaten a tortilla, chances are all the wheat came from the Yaqui Valley. Remember, I'm in a desert, 15 inches of rain, but there's millions of acres of wheat and other agriculture. They irrigate it. And all that irrigation water goes into little ditches that go into big ditches that just eventually drain off into low-lying areas. They're too low to farm and or drain off into those estuaries. And it's just the fresh water is what brings these birds in. But this program here, we typically leave at somewhere between 3:45 and 4:30, depending on where we're going to hunt that morning. We leave and we hunt until 11 or 12 o'clock. We come back and eat a box lunch at the truck, sometimes in the blind. And then on the way back to town, we stop and dove hunt or jump shoot ducks. And so it's an all day event, and I'm on mountain time, so I'm an hour behind Mississippi. If we're going to record next week, and I'm just saying this time for me would be after about 6:30 p.m. Mississippi time and before Margarita p.m. Mexico time. Somewhere in that time frame there, we'll get together and talk again. I'm glad to see you back on there, Rocky.
Yeah, we'll get something scheduled back up next week. But Ramsey, be careful while you're down there. Stay safe. Get a lot of stuff. I want to thank you again for being here. We want to thank all of you that listened to this edition of the End of the Line podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.